Hey guys, the following podcast is a Lady Gang Network and Podcast One production, which means it's going to be awesome.
Today's episode of The Stacks is brought to you in partnership with Libro FM. Libro FM is an audiobook platform that allows you to buy your audiobooks directly from your favorite independent bookstore. Joining Libro FM is about more than just books. It's about being an active member in your community, even when you're shopping online. Libro FM is making it easy for you to get started with an offer of two audiobooks for the price of one when you use our code THESTACKS at checkout. So head to Libro.fm to redeem. That's Libro.fm and use the code THESTACKS, all one word. Next time you're thinking of buying an audiobook, consider making the switch to Libro FM. Your favorite booksellers will thank you. Welcome to The Stacks, a podcast about books and the people who read them. I'm your host, Tracy Thomas, and today on the show, we have Mina Harris. She is the founder and CEO of the Phenomenal Women's Action Campaign, which you may know from the gray Phenomenal Woman t-shirts. She's also the author of a brand new children's book called Kamala and Maya's Big Idea, based on true events from the childhood of her mother and aunt, Maya and Kamala Harris. We talk today about diversifying books for kids, community organizing, and we remind ourselves that we've got to make sure that we're doing something, whether it be big or small. You can find everything we discuss on today's episode in the link in the show notes. Before we dive into today's episode, I just wanted to give a quick shout out to our supporters over on Patreon, aka the Stacks Pack. Patreon is an easy way to help me make this show by committing to a small monthly contribution and earning perks like our virtual book club. It's easy and it has an outsized impact on my ability to make the Stacks week in and week out. So with that being said, I just want to give a quick thank you to Katie Lohr, Sherry Maple, Sarah Hibbard, Alyssa Fisher, Meredith and Katie, Danielle Kloster, Megan Clark, Marissa Isengart, Nikki Brown, Stacey Chin, Michaela, and Crystal Dunavant. Okay, now let's talk with Mina Harris. All right, you guys, I'm so excited. I'm here with Mina Harris. Mina, welcome to The Stacks. I'm so excited you're here.
Thank you. I'm excited. We were just talking about how we haven't seen each other in forever. So it's amazing. I guess we're still not seeing each other, but to connect virtually after all these years. So thanks for having me.
So for everyone who probably doesn't know, besides maybe like my brother who might possibly be listening, Mina and I went to high school together.
Yes.
So we're both Oakland girls, Bishop O'Dowd Dragon alumni. You're the second Dragon alumni on the show, and the other Dragon alumni, Jesse Bird, also a children's book author.
No way.
Yeah.
I have to check that out. I had no idea. Or check her out. I had no idea.
It's a he. Boy, Jesse.
Sorry, Jesse.
But it's okay.
Like,
but you should. He has a cold.
What year was he?
He's a year younger than me, so that's 05.
Okay.
And he has a whole like children's book company all focused on children of color and diverse voices. And it's not just his books that he writes, but he also, you know, it's like a publishing house that he has.
Wow.
Jesse B. Creative.
I have to connect with him.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay.
Anyways, welcome. So we always start here in about 30 seconds or so. Tell us about your book, Kamala and Maya's Big Idea.
It is about two sisters named Kamala and Maya. It's actually based on a true story from the childhood of my mom, Maya, and Aunt Kamala. And it's all about these two sisters who see a problem in their neighborhood, or rather in their apartment complex, and decide that they're going to go solve it. And they come up with this big idea and they figure out how to accomplish it. And it's all about, as I said, problem solving. It's about leaning on your community to get something done that is for the betterment of your community. It's sort of these early lessons, right, in community organizing and community love. It's also about, you know, two powerful, strong girl character bosses who are leading the way and who are persevering in the face of people telling them no and adults telling them you're too small or you're too young or, you know, it can't be done, and figuring it out and doing that by leaning on their, bringing their community together to do something that ultimately is beneficial to the community. So it's been really special from, you know, sort of a personal standpoint to get to share this story that was something that I loved hearing growing up, not only with my own daughters, which is really what inspired it initially, but to share it with kids all over the world.
Yeah. And it's such a great story. And I mean, I am obviously drawn to it because you wrote it, but also when I actually got to read it, I was like, wow, this is so great. The illustrations are beautiful. It's two diverse, you know, two women of color or girls of color characters leading the way, surrounded by a community of diverse faces. And I thought that that is, I always find that to be very powerful in children's books because I know that that is not the norm. What compelled you to say, okay, now I'm going to tell the story of my mom and my aunt for kids?
Well, exactly that, which you just said, which is one of the big reasons. I mean, there were several, but to build on what you just said, it was me becoming a new mom myself and, you know, reading the classics, Good Night Moon and Brown Bear and, you know, The Hungry Caterpillar. And those are all, I think, really important, you know, works of children's literature. And we've read all of them. But I also found myself at a certain point wondering where the characters were that looked like my daughter, right? Or reflected what my environment was growing up. And that lack of representation led us to, you know, sometimes color the skin of characters, of white characters in brown. And you know, changing the pronouns from he to she, you know, to they, and it just became more and more apparent to me, right, that we are still underrepresented. We, meaning girl characters, strong girl characters, girls of color, are still so underrepresented on bookshelves. And so that was a huge thing for me, right? Diversity in kids' books. And then the other, as I was reading them as a new mom, one thing that I think is interesting and that I feel grateful for is that my older one was born around the same time that you did see this sort of burst of what you might call like feminist children's literature, right? You know, Rad Women from A to Z, Rebel Girls, A is for Activist was a big one that a lot of like my parent friends were gifting to each other. So sort of teaching social justice, but in particular, the, you know, Rebel Girls series was a huge thing. And it still is. But there also came a point where I felt like I was like reading my kids like lists of women in history, right? Which is, again, not to diminish how important that is. Of course, we are, you know, we focus on teaching them history and that matters so much. But I'm also just like, can we have relatable, like fictional, right, characters that they can like actually imagine themselves in those settings and see themselves in, instead of, you know, basically talking about lists of like women who aren't even alive anymore, right? And also who are framed in the context of like doing something heroic and groundbreaking and the first woman to do this. And again, that stuff is so important.
Right.
However, I also felt like, can we just have girls existing in the world the way that my kids do, right?
I was just going to say, and the way that little boys get to exist in these books, right? Like there's so many stories in children's books about little boys, you know, going to the store, or little boys having a bad day, or little boys playing with their brother. And it's like, if you're a little girl, the book is either you are, you know, Marie Curie, or you don't exist because you've been portrayed as a dragon instead. Like there's no, there's
or
no just like every day.
Right. Exactly. It's not just sort of like existing. One of my friends, I found this to be a great way to put it, which was, she had like messaged me about my book and said, thank you for just, you know, putting these regular relatable characters into the world. Her son is half Chinese. And she, said likewise that she just wants a book that has a, you know, Chinese character, main character, that's not about like Chinese New Year, right? Like this is just sort of relatable existing in the world without it having to be like an aggressively, like, you know, in your face book about diversity or culture. Right. And I think we're seeing this in lots of different places in terms of the progress we're making, including, you know, in Hollywood. Why can't James Bond be a black man or a black woman for that matter? Right.
Yeah.
So likewise, I felt like, and to your point, yeah, the default is a white boy. Marley Diaz, the young, you know, book education activist, says like, they just want me to read about a white boy and his dog. And it's true. Even in the progress that we have made, if you look at, you know, there is a lot more diversity. If there's like a group of children, right, there's you're likely going to find like a black kid, but they're also the supporting character. They are not usually the main character. So, you know, that stuff, it just became, I was sort of on my own journey as well. And kind of noticing this along the way. I hadn't, before I had kids, really like dug into this issue. It's not surprising to me, right? I mean, I think the publishing industry, like every industry, likely, you know, can use more diverse voices, but it became more and more frustrating for me as a parent. And was like, you know what, I'm just going to go to write this shit myself.
Right.
So that was that. Diversity in children's literature was like one huge thing. And then the other that it coincided with was, you know, coming out of the election, many of the same reasons, you know, why I decided to launch Phenomenal, which was, you know, we were seeing this incredible moment, which now has, you know, lasted much longer than a moment, I think, and I hope lasts much longer than this administration. But, you know, it's people speaking up and women, right, through my brand coming together saying, how can I do more? How can I be more civically engaged? You know, what does it mean to be an activist? How do I, you know, get more involved? And I've been having these conversations with women for the last 3 years, you know, let alone with adult women, let alone thinking about how do we talk to our kids about this stuff? How do we really, you know, build households and build up children in this sort of way. And that, of course, was how I was raised. And right. So the more and more I was engaging with that, I also came to have such a deep appreciation for, in many ways, what a unique, you know, household I grew up in, where this was sort of just all around me all the time. And then thinking about, you know, how do I emulate that, seeing what my grandmother did, what my mother did, what my aunt did for me, and how impactful that was, informative it was for me. How do I pass it on to my own kids? Right. I appreciate that in many ways it was not only intentional, but some of it was also driven by like circumstance and necessity, right. To sort of be around the work constantly. I had a, you know, single mom, basically single grandma. So just sort of around us all the time. And, I think often about, you know, how do I give that to my daughters, even though, you know, we're in a different situation where we have a lot of support and as a two-parent household and all that. And then also just cherishing those stories, right? Right. And cherishing those values and lessons and thinking about how do I pass that on to them, and what an extraordinary way it could be to do that through a children's book, not only for them, but for everyone, right? And to really use this to have those conversations. And so in that way, I think of it as not just for children. I think that it really can be something that can guide, you know, parents and how they think about, you know, how we raise our kids in this sort of new era.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I think one of the major lessons in the book is that it's a line in the book, but I also think it's probably, if I was going to say this is the thesis of the book, right? If you do that with children's books, which I don't think you do, but if you do, I would say it's something along the lines of no one can do everything, but everyone could do something. And I'm just curious, is that like a refrain from your own childhood? Is that something that you heard a lot growing up? Because it just is such a powerful, succinct line. It just felt it really landed with me. So I'm just curious if that's something that you've grown up with, or if that's something you developed on your own recently, or like kind of how that line came to you.
Absolutely. It was something that was constantly reminded to me, right, as a kid growing up in that household. I mean, right. So everyone can do something was really the part that was a refrain in my household. And yeah. Another way of saying it is that, you know, everyone has a role to play. And then further to that, especially in my household and the way I was raised, it was that we have a responsibility, right, to play that role and to step up no matter how small. You may not be able to save the world, but you can do something and you have to do something. If you have any bit of privilege or access or, you know, voice, like go do something. And it was really important in sort of those lessons that I was taught, not only what was communicated to me in terms of those values, but it was also to me through action, you know, from the fact that, you know, my mom and aunt were, you know, public interest lawyers, right? They were doing that social justice work. But then even with my grandmother, who wasn't, you know, she wasn't an elected official. She wasn't somebody who sort of had, so any kind of celebrity about her, was just going about her life. But, you know, when we were at the grocery store, taught me that we were boycotting grapes and that we weren't buying grapes because Cesar Chavez was fasting, right, to call attention to the plight of farm workers and families and their families. And he those sorts of lessons at the grocery store, right? And other instances of her just showing everyday, you know, everyday ways of showing up with your activism. And so that's very much what the lesson is. And it's something that I think, again, when you ask, like, is it something that I came up recently? It's definitely something that I've been building on through Phenomenal, which is that it's something that I talk to adults about all the time, right? Like, it can feel overwhelming. There's just so much happening in the world. There's so much suffering. I mean, even especially right now during this pandemic, right? But where do you start, right? How do you really have an impact? And my answer is that you have to start somewhere. You have to take that first step. You have to commit to, you know, an issue and go for it, no matter how small. And for me, you know, with Phenomenal Woman, it was like putting a slogan, you know, putting an inspiring phrase on a t-shirt. I didn't know where that was going to go, but it felt right. And it felt good in that moment. And frankly, the same thing with the kids book. I never had on my like bucket list or, you know, my aspirations to be an author. Certainly not a children's book author. This was not something that like I had planned to do. It was very much responding in the moment and saying, you know, I'm not sort of seeing what I want to see for my, you know, what I'm in terms of what I'm reading to my children, and I'm going to go try to write it myself.
Right.
And see where it goes.
Right. So since it wasn't something that was on your bucket list or something that you thought that you would do, what's the experience been like? Have you enjoyed it? Do you think you'll do it again? Would you consider writing for adults? Like, it's something that so many people, you know, have so many questions about. So I'm curious, as a person who's kind of an outsider to the book world, what it was like for you.
Oh man, that's a hard question to ask me right now.
I'm sure because you're in the thick of it.
Exactly. Like, there's layers to it, right? I think the first layer of what was what inspired me to write it and the process of writing it and getting to work with an incredible illustrator and having a collaborative relationship with her in terms of the process. I mean, that was just extraordinary and amazing. It's the sort of beginnings of, you know, coming up with this concept and this story and bringing it to life. That is the most, gratifying, incredible experience. So that's like the first piece of it.
Right.
The second is, you know, like actually getting the book into the world and dealing with, you know, publishing and distribution and like selling the book. And that second half, I have lots of thoughts. I'm still learning the industry, but it is hard. It is hard to sell books. It is even harder to sell books during a pandemic.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm curious about it though. And I think, I certainly have interest in building on this experience and doing more, but I think I will need to like, just give myself that space to like step back and really think about all of my learnings. And in part, I look at it in the context of what I've done with Phenomenal, right? Which is what I think at its core is about storytelling and messaging and, you know, distilling, I think, you know, compelling stories into accessible content that you can then, you know, distribute to mass audiences is, I think, what it is at its core. And that's what this book is as well. But yeah, the whole process of selling a book. So when you ask me like, am I going to do it again? I'm like, oh, I'm so exhausted.
Right.
Let me just get through this one. But you know, I think, as I said, I mean, it's an old industry and I it's very interesting to see, how it operates and to think as an entrepreneur, as I am, you know, ways in which it can be improved or, you know, innovated upon, and I'm still learning.
Right.
So I'll have to report back.
Right.
But I will say I'm very intrigued by it. I'm curious about it. And I'm definitely committed to doing more. And what I have seen so far is, you know, on the topic, back to the topic of diversity, we are seeing progress, right? We are seeing that more voices are getting access and are able to tell their stories. I think we're seeing, you know, just it's slow progress, but we're seeing progress. And what else? I think, you know, there's also shifts in the marketplace in terms of the ability to publish independently, right? Mm-hmm. That I think create some interesting new dynamics. But anyway, I'm not an expert yet, but I definitely am intrigued by it and want to learn more and committed to, you know, sticking with it and doing more.
Yeah, well, we should talk offline about that because I have many thoughts about the publishing industry, which I was definitely an outsider until now that I feel like I'm a weirdly insidery consumer because I don't write and that's like not me at all, but I consume a ton of books and I deal a lot with publishers and I'm, you know, I'm tangentially connected to the industry and we should definitely chat more about the diversity aspect because I think like a lot of things like Hollywood you were mentioning, there is an outward show of diversity that isn't necessarily reflected in the ranks of who's making the books and who's gatekeeping. So
exactly.
That's what's interesting, at least for me, from what I can see in the reports that I've been able to get access to. So,
yep, no, it's exactly right in terms of who's making decisions, who's right, like actually publishing these works. I was stunned. I mean, again, I started paying way more attention as I became a new mom and I was reading books to my kids, but then also, especially as a new author, and you know, when you talk about gatekeeping and what are, you know, these sort of institutions that give people, you know, credibility or validation or help them to sell their works, right? Like New York Times bestseller list or whatever else, like they are predominantly white male authors and white male illustrators.
Yeah.
Last I checked. And I was actually shocked by that, which maybe it's not surprising, right? Like I said at the beginning, every institution suffers from this issue. But I don't know. I did not expect that. And yeah, we have a lot more work to do. And I think part of it too is just like, maybe this pandemic will force that, right, in terms of how we conceive of distribution and getting these into the hands of readers. Right. And anyway, it's a huge separate topic that I've become super fascinated by and very curious about. So I'd love to talk about it more.
Yeah, definitely. We brought this up. You've mentioned it a few times, but I do want to talk about Ana Ramirez Gonzalez, who's your illustrator. Mm-hmm. I want to know how you connected with her, how you decided to use her and how you guys work together, what the process was like as far as deciding what got illustrations and how they looked and that sort of stuff.
Yeah. You know, I mean, that was actually one sort of peculiar feature of this process that was new to me and surprising to me in terms of what I expected, having never done this before going into it. So, and you probably already know this, but you as an author don't have a lot of choice in who your illustrator is.
And, I don't know that. That's interesting. Oh, interesting. I didn't know that.
And I mean, this may vary. I've heard this and I've heard other people talk about it on other podcasts. It may be particular to a publisher, right? I don't know if it's right. Sort of across the industry. But what I'll say is that, you know, I came up with this idea. I started, you know, mocking up illustrations on my own. I myself am a creative sort of artistic person. And so that was immediately where my mind went, was like starting to draw it out. And then, you know, started the process of starting like drafting out the text. But I immediately like went to Instagram and started looking at all of these illustrators. And I knew I knew that I wanted to have a woman of color as the illustrator. And, you know, as a mom, as I said, two little kids that I was reading books to, I had some sense of sort of who was out there in terms mm-hmm. of, you know, women of color illustrators. For example, I think the big one that a lot of people know now is Vashti Harrison. Yeah. Who, has, you know, Little Leaders and Hair Love and has done a lot of extraordinary work. Anyway, so I was like, oh my God, I want to go like look at all the options I have, right? And I'm like scrolling through Instagram and I literally still have a note on my phone of like Black women illustrators, Indian American illustrators, like I have a whole, you know, Latina illustrators. And then I talked to my publisher and it was basically like, you can choose from a list. We're going to give you a list of like five for you to choose from, which was really surprising to me. I didn't realize that was how the, you know, process worked, at least for me. And that's not to say though, I mean, Ana really stood out for me, for a number of reasons. One, she's a visual development, artist for Pixar and worked on the film Coco, which is a favorite of my kids. And literally, I mean, it's one of my favorite animated, you know, recent animated movies of all time. I love it so much, from the culture to, I mean, her style with, you know, lots of florals, right? It's all about Day of the Dead and all the bright flowers. And so anyway, her style, I mean, just really captured my attention quickly. And as I said, I myself am sort of a creative artistic person. So I had very strong opinions about that and sort of, you know, what I'm drawn to. So it was really immediate for me. And as much as it was something that, you know, as I said, it was more so the publisher giving me, you know, a small, you know, list of options and my choosing from it. I couldn't have asked for a better illustrator in Ana. And I'm so happy that I was able to discover her through my publisher, because I may not have otherwise. She lives in Oakland, which is where I'm from, where we're from. Yeah. So that was also very special to me to have also a Latina. Artist and illustrator was super important to me. So I spoke to sort of the process and how that was, to the extent you have authors, you know, or people who are interested in writing kids' books who are interested in the process, but the outcome is something that I'm grateful for and happy with.
What was the hardest part for you writing this book, and what of this book came sort of easily?
Yeah, I was just talking about this it was interesting to kind of go back and think through the process. The easiest part for me was like mocking up what I was seeing and the visuals, like turning page to page and here's what you see next. And then it goes to this scene, which is funny because I'm like a left brain, right brain person. Okay. I can do both.
Okay.
But what was funny is it was definitely sort of the creative that was coming out. Whereas the most challenging part was the writing. It just like was everyone will tell you this. I mean, there's a very specific way to write for kids. And I'm like, you know, I'm trained as a lawyer. I'm like pretty verbose. Like it's not, you know, I've done some like contributing and writing outside of, you know, the legal field, but like, yeah, the writing, it was just totally different. And I had to basically like cut down, a ton of text because I was just sort of just writing too much. But what's interesting is the final product, I think, is much more true to my visuals and sort of how I imagined, you know, each scene in terms of illustrations than it is to the actual like draft text, which I think is kind of interesting.
Yeah, that is
although not surprising, knowing that I'm in terms of the creative process, much more of a sort of visual arts person.
Right. So as far as your process goes for writing, you have like 1,001 jobs. You're a very busy person. How did you make time to write the book? How did you make time to sort out what this was going to be and do your storyboarding and do like, how did you find the space in your day to do that?
You know, this actually kind of happens to me with other types of writing where I procrastinate for a really long time and then I sit down and I just like dump the whole thing out and I can bang it out in like a day or, you know, depending on how long the thing is. And I've noticed that over time, I think part of it is that I'm just like building it up in my head and I'm procrastinating and my body and my mind is telling me like, you're not ready to like let it out yet.
Right.
And you're sort of like marinating on it. So that's all to say that I literally sat down and I don't even know how, I think it was over the course of like a weekend or something. And just kind of like dumped the whole thing out, including the, as I said, mocking up the illustrations and then writing out the whole story. I think one unique, you know, aspect of this is that it is based on a true story. So I had a sort of, right, like core narrative plot that I knew I was working from. And so it wasn't like completely from scratch, which I think probably helped like accelerate that or just make it more clear sort of build around that in terms of telling the story.
And where did you do your writing? Do you have a specific like writing spot or are you one of those people who can work anywhere?
Oh God, this is also like, I'm still evolving on this. this is like perhaps a whole separate conversation, but we've been living in this house that we're in now for almost 4 years.
Okay.
And I work from home a lot. I have an office downtown, but it's a tech company. So we have the, you know, flexibility. I did not get like a full fledged, like dedicated space and desk until the pandemic.
Oh, wow.
And it's life changing, as anyone I'm sure like that writers will tell you, other, you know, freelancers.
Right.
But I think part of it is I just hadn't like committed to like thinking about how to create that space for myself. And holy fuck, excuse my language. It's such a game changer. So this is a very, sorry, long one. And I have like lots of opinions on that now, but I did not have it when I wrote this. And so I literally feel like I was hunched over on my like couch in our bedroom.
Yeah.
It was not at all like a dedicated author writer space by any means. And so in that way, I think was like pretty messy, in terms of the process, but you know, I'm obviously that's also where the editor and the publisher play a huge role, right? In helping you to refine that and to, really package it in a way that, is going to be appealing to readers. And I definitely had help there and I'm grateful for that. And I think next time around, you know, I may be able to put something together that's like a bit tighter or easier to work with. But for me, it just felt like I was kind of just dumping all of my thoughts and, you know, visuals like onto a Google Doc.
Right. You might be surprised to know that I talk to a lot of authors all the time and many of them don't have a dedicated writing space. A lot of them.
Really?
Like this question, the answers I get range from, I have one place that I write at all times to I sometimes write in the backseat of my car. I pull out my computer and pull over on the side of the road and write if something comes to me, to I go to a hotel and I order dinner and I write in a hotel lobby. Like, people have all sorts of different things. And I kind of thought, like you, when I got started, that the answers would be the same, right? That people would constantly say this one thing. And that's why the question is also kind of evolved from where do you write to like, do you write somewhere or can you write anywhere? Funny. What are you doing?
I would be so interested to study this, like different personalities or, you know, creative minds, like how it may be different across different people. I think, as I said, I'm much more of a creative minded person. And I think, I don't know, sometimes I think it's just like an excuse to be messy, but I like that. It'll be bottled up, or I've been thinking about it sort of passively, and then I'll be in an Uber and it'll hit me and I'm like, oh shit, I got to get out my iPhone notes and just like jam through whatever's wanting to spill out of my brain.
Yeah, totally.
That happens to me all the time. And yeah, I'll like sort of, you know, or I'll be on like my Peloton. And the other thing in terms of my creative process, I've realized how important it is to like create that just white space. Those moments when I am like overbooked and I'm going from meeting to meeting to meeting and my brain is just sort of like overwhelmed and it doesn't have that freedom. And I find that in those moments where I have created that stillness or spaciousness, then it just kind of like flows out. So I'll be trying to rush through my exercise. I'm like, oh my God, I got to get my phone out before I forget like what this brilliant idea is or whatever came to me. Like, I have to write it down somewhere. Anyway, it's just so interesting to hear different people's processes. And in the same way, I've realized that depending on the type of writing, right? I may need a quieter space or I enjoy sitting in a coffee shop. I love sitting in coffee shops, but I often, and you know, just enjoying people being around me and being outside. I'm talking to like wistfully.
I know, like, that feels like the most impossible thing now.
But yeah, I don't know. I think it's sort of just, I'm all over the place, which again, as I said, I think is just, it's my excuse for being a disorganized, messy creative.
It's okay. We all have our shit.
But it's new for me. I mean, as you know, like my journey, I'm sort of still coming into it, right? Like I'm still like coming into being an entrepreneur. I haven't been doing this for like, it's always been in me, but, I sort of was forcing myself on a different, like much more traditional path of, you know, law school and clerking and becoming a lawyer and doing policy stuff, when that's like probably not really who I am.
Yeah.
We want to go really deep here.
Right. Wait, I do want to come back to that. But before we leave your writing setup, this question is one of my most favorites, which is, did you have or do you have any writing snacks or beverages that were your go-to when you would sit down to write?
Oh, that's a good question.
I just love snacks, so I like to know.
No, I know. That's funny. You know, I think maybe I'm not a huge snacker, and let me be very clear that it has nothing to do with me trying to like be on a diet or like watch my food intake. I think, as I said, it's sort of like I sit down and I jam, you know, and if I have like salt and vinegar chips on my fingers, like it's hard to tie, it's like distracting. And, which is to say that like, if I'm snacking, I'm probably not typing on my computer.
Right.
So I think I've created a pretty good like separation. Maybe people are like, get a fucking napkin. But I feel like it like slows down. I don't know. It feels like it interrupts the process or something, you know?
That's fair.
So yeah, I think that's a really interesting question. I think I tend not to snack while I, am on my computer. I'm trying to think, I guess even when I'm like at a tech company, like in the office where, you know, there's tons of snacks.
So many snacks.
I think usually I'll like go to the cafe and like eat some almonds, but I'm not like super like snacking throughout the day. But that was, to answer your question, that was my go-to when I was like working in an office. But I think that's, I just like, I'm not really good at keeping snacks. I don't know. There's so many adjustments here in life and going from the office to my home workspace.
Yeah.
Which is something that it's been interesting to sort of figure out, like, what are my habits in this different space, or what do I sort of thrive on in trying to really figure that out. Anyway, at home I don't snack as much.
Okay, that's fair. Lucky you, because all I do is snack. It's like I eat everything, but you know, whatever. Yeah. To each his own. More snacks for me.
I feel like it's such a like process to like, I don't know, you know, again, at a tech company, it's like you have a million different options.
Right.
Whereas for me, it's like, okay, should I get the sweet potato chips? And then if I do, I eat the whole bag in one sitting. So they don't really become a, like a snack that I can regularly snack on. I don't, we have goldfish, but again, I'll like eat them in one sitting or like with a bottle of wine.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I think my conclusion is like not a very good snacker unless somebody provides snacks to me in snack form, such as my tech company.
Right. Okay. I want to go back to your work outside of the book, because I think it would be crazy not to talk about the Phenomenal Woman Action Campaign. I kind of know the origin story, but I guess you should probably tell the people at home who maybe aren't familiar with it. But the people at home, you've definitely seen the shirt if you've been following the podcast, because I'm often wearing it in pictures. It's my the gray shirt that says Phenomenal Woman is where it all started. But if you want to tell people a little bit about what that work and also about the Phenomenal Girl shirt.
Yeah. So the gray Phenomenal Woman shirt is indeed where it all started. It was a very, very small idea, which, and now it's a big idea, right? Building on my book and everything that's come from it. But it initially was a fundraising campaign to raise money for women's organizations, you know, coming out of the 2016 election. I think like a lot of people, I came out of that thinking, you know, wow, what just happened and what can I do? How can I be more involved? How can I, you know, speak up and do my part? Again, back to some of these lessons that I hope I'm imparting through the book. And for me, it was creating this t-shirt inspired by the poem Phenomenal Woman by Maya Angelou. If you recall, the election was very focused on women. Mm-hmm. We were going into the Women's March. There were these big, you know, headlines, are women going to step up? Are women going to, you know, do their part? And I was, you know, thinking a lot about that and what I could do in my own sort of space. And I had a smaller t-shirt before that kind of took off in its own way that was focused on women entrepreneurs. And so I wasn't like new to the t-shirt game. I was able to quickly spin up this shirt and we were selling them. We launched it on International Women's Day and we were supposed to sell the t-shirts through the month of March for Women's History Month to raise money for women's organizations. Again, if you remember back then, a lot of people were and continue to, which I think is an amazing moment that we're in, right? We're hosting personal fundraisers for the ACLU, for Planned Parenthood, right? And so we were doing that too. And I expected to sell, you know, some modest amount of shirts and make a small impact in my own way. And we ended up selling 2,500 shirts on the first day, which was totally unexpected. And it's, you know, the rest is history. I kept, you know, thinking about how can we keep building it? How can we reach people? How can we raise more money? And it kept growing and growing. And so, you know, it started off with that one great. And I remember back then everyone was like, can you make a, you know, different color? Can you do pink for breast cancer awareness? Can you do this for that? And I was just like, I'm sorry, no, like I have a day job. I have like, this is enough. It's doing well. It's, you know, I'm doing my part. And now here we are 3.5 years later and we have like dozens of different styles and, you know, all kinds of different, campaigns and nonprofit partners. So, you know, I approached it as a community organizer, I approached it as an entrepreneur and, you know, thought, how can I use this thing, this platform, this tangible, you know, really small, but concrete thing like a t-shirt, to reach people with, important messages around, you know, issues that affect, in particular, underrepresented communities. And we started off, you know, focusing on women and particularly women of color. And our first sort of big issue was equal pay. And so we were doing big campaigns around, you know, Black Women's Equal Pay Day, Indigenous Native Women's Equal Pay Day, Latina Equal Pay Day. And then, you know, we just kept growing and growing. And most recently, we did a campaign around farm workers for you know, drawing attention to their working conditions and the need for greater protections. They're designated as essential workers, but historically, especially the federal government has not treated them as such.
Right.
So raising awareness through Phenomenal Farm Worker campaign. We also did a campaign around the anti-Asian racism that we are seeing coming out of, you know, the pandemic early on. Well, actually a year ago, we launched a campaign called Phenomenally Asian. It was for Asian American Heritage Month. And we brought that back. Right. And the whole idea too, is how do you, take what can be a very serious, complex, and sort of not, positive or fun issue, right? Such as racism or, pay inequity, and use something like the, you know, Phenomenally Asian t-shirt or Phenomenal Woman t-shirt to raise awareness around those issues, but to do it in a way that is still lifting up and celebrating in a positive way,
right,
those communities. And I think that's what is really awesome about it. And not only does it, you know, allow folks to, you know, get sort of greater an audience around these issues that impact them that may otherwise have not been paying attention, but it's doing it in a way that's actually celebrating them and also lifting them up.
Right. And for people who don't know, I will link to the Phenomenal Woman Action Campaign website in the show notes, of course, but the money goes, like the money from purchasing these shirts goes to support these different organizations through these campaigns, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So we've had, at this point, I think like over a dozen different organizations, and we've done different sort of formats. For the most part, it's we split them across all of our organizations that participate. But we've also done specific campaigns for specific organizations. And, you know, we did, let's see, Phenomenal Mother, that was in collaboration with Families Belong Together. It's all about raising awareness around family separation and family detention. And as I said, the positive aspect of it is we're celebrating those mothers who are coming, you know, to the United States, risking everything to create a better life for their children, and also celebrating all the incredible mothers in the United States who are stepping up and saying, I have to do something about this. And I have to, you know, figure out how I can be impactful around this issue because I can't sit by.
Right.
So yeah, we have all kinds of different campaigns and issues and partners, and it's still growing.
Yeah. And then with the book, you have the Phenomenal Girl campaign. This episode will be out after the pre-order promotion you're running, but will they still be able to get their hands on the Phenomenal Girl shirts?
So the pre-order campaign, which it will be over, but I'll explain it quickly because I think it's still going to be relevant in terms of supporting local bookstores, which is that we have 25 independent local bookstore partners across the country. If you pre-order from one of those stores, you can get a Phenomenal Girl, free Phenomenal Girl t-shirt. We launched the pre-order campaign before the pandemic happened because we know how vital, you know, local bookstores are to right. our communities and wanted to support them. And of course, now that we're in the pandemic, we know how much more it matters, right? A lot of these businesses are just trying to stay afloat. And they've told us, you know, across all of our different partners that every online order makes a difference. Every pre-order makes a difference. So once the pre-order campaign ends, which will be, I guess, June 1st, the day before the book comes out, we will then launch to be available to the public to buy the Phenomenal Girl t-shirt. So right now, you can only get it as a pre-order gift. And we're also going to be doing another special giveaway that supports local bookstores. Once the book is out, if you order during launch week, we'll have another cool thing. So look out for that.
Awesome. That's awesome. Okay. I want to talk a little bit about Mina, the personality, because you kind of have become this like online person, right? Like you were,
God, I'm like,
well, you have, don't you think, or no?
I don't know. Ask your question.
Well, my question is that you are kind of a voice of women of color of a certain kind of age, right? This millennial, you know, group of which I consider myself to be part of. You've kind of become mm-hmm. a voice from our generation that's speaking up on these issues, and you're launching these campaigns, and your social media has a presence, and your t-shirts are seen everywhere. And like, there is some notoriety that comes with being Mina Harris, you know, niece to presidential candidate Kamala Harris. Like, you are definitely someone that people are familiar with in some way or another. Maybe not everybody, but like in certain circles, I guess is what I mean by that. And so my question is, how do you balance being this presence and your own kind of mental health in this crazy social media landscape and with all the racism and the vitriol and the anti-womanness and all this stuff? Like, how do you kind of keep your wits about you and keep doing the work and not just say, you know what, I need a very long break for like 6 years?
I'm not going to lie. It's hard and exhausting. I think I'll start by saying I'm grateful, right, to have access to, you know, getting to have a family member do something historic and to be a part of that. And in many ways, I feel super, super lucky to have this experience. But at the same time, as you've already noted, it comes along with a lot of other stuff. And to answer your question, I think the number one like value that I try to lead with, which is going to sound so freaking corny, is being authentic.
Right.
And like being true to myself. Obviously I'm in a particular situation where I have to navigate like politics and having a family in politics. And there's a whole bunch of things that come along with that. But you know, for better or for worse, in terms of whether or not my mom likes to see me saying fuck on Twitter all the time, or, you know, other, like, I just have to, I, for my own like sanity, I have to be able to be myself.
Right.
And so that's like the number one thing for me. I think with that though, also comes, you know, you already mentioned like trolls and just people being evil online. And I deal with that a lot. And I think when you are public, right, I am accessible. Right. People can also use that in a way to act out and feel sort of, I'm trying to be careful in how I phrase this. I'll put it another way. I could choose to be not public, right?
Right.
I could choose to be totally private and to not be on social. And I think, and I know a lot of people who are in similar circumstances to me who choose that or have chosen that for, you know, particular moments in their life. I don't know. I can't do that. I'm somebody who, you know, I'm passionate about the work that I do, and I do it, separate and apart from, right, my experience of being in this family and being associated with that stuff. And that's my passion. And I'm not going to, it goes to the point of being authentic. Like, I'm not going to do something that feels unnatural for me or is not sort of living out my true self.
Right.
But with that comes, yeah, having to sort of juggle all the other not so pleasant things. And to answer your question more directly, it varies day by day. Sometimes I decide that I do need to step away right. and sort of like log off for that day. Sometimes it means I ask myself, do I want to engage with this person? And sometimes I do. And I like clap back at people. Maybe I'm like in a mood and I'm like, oh, you want to come at me? Like, let's go. Right. And sometimes I text one of my best friends and I'm like, should I engage with this? And they're like, don't you fucking say anything back to that person. I'm like, all right, I won't do it. You know, it's just like, and so I guess I'll say I also feel very lucky to have folks in my circle who trust and who are incredibly supportive and who I can lean on in those moments where I'm just like, oh my God, I have to deal with this thing. And, you know, what should I do? Or I'm thinking right. about, you know, and so having that, I have become even more just thankful for, you know, those friendships and to have that support because, you know, it's kind of just nasty. If I'm being honest, what's happening. And I think when I put myself in the shoes of sort of everyday folks that are also dealing with this, it makes me worried, right? I think I experience it in a much more extreme way, but I think everybody is worried about, you know, getting attacked online. Or I shouldn't even say I think, I know. There was a period where I was doing a bunch of speaking events, and there was one week where I had received the same question on a panel like 3 times in 1 week, which was, how do you deal with like online criticism and trolls? And what it suggested to me was that like people were worried about this, right? And I'm sitting up there telling them to speak out and do right and use your voice. And I think a lot of people want to do that, and they're thinking about more ways to engage, but they're also worried to put themselves out there. That's totally valid. So anyway, I think I am concerned about, you know, what's happening online, and every day is different.
Yeah.
In terms of my own like legal health and how I decide to like engage.
Yeah,
with
I'm
it.
Sure. I'm sure. I have to ask, this is maybe more personally curious. What was it like being so intimately close to a presidential campaign? What's that like? Is it just wild? Like, you're with your family and it's also like such a huge moment for the country. What was that experience like?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. My experience with it wasn't like totally new,
right.
I guess, is like a weird way to phrase it, right? Like,
right.
Obviously, one, she's running for other offices, higher office. And so I've had the experience of, you know, I've worked on a number of her campaigns, but Attorney General and then U.S. Senate. And then as well, I've worked on other presidential campaigns.
Right.
And so I think for some people that may just be like a random family member, and then their family member decides to run for president, it's like, holy shit, what just happened?
Right.
It wasn't like told. And she's also one of my closest family members, you know?
Of course.
So
yeah.
I forget sometimes that like not everybody has that like relationship with an aunt, and she's like my only, it's like my mom's only sister. Anyway, so in that way, there was a lot of it that I feel like was kind of familiar in terms mm-hmm. of things that I've already experienced. But then back, you know, Bill, the last question you asked me, I mean, everything was intensified in terms sure. of all the stuff. And so I think it was constant, you know, inspiration. I was incredibly proud of her. It was extraordinary to see her on the world stage, like right. doing this. And my God, I mean, that was one of the most incredible, you know, things I've ever been able to have a front row seat to in my life. And it was mixed with like incredible anxiety and yeah. like, you know, just the, it's also scary to see a family member, one of my closest family members, out there like that. So I don't know. It's, I almost feel like, it's like being a, what is it? What's the term? Like a stage mom or like yeah. a, is that the term? yeah. No, but like you're like, stick the landing, like just get it done. And
yeah.
just like, you know, constant like anxiety. But anyway,
so funny.
I also, you know, I'm always, I think the most beautiful things about any election, but in particular, you know, presidential elections, is that it if you do view it from the positive of it, like you get to connect with so many incredible people who fucking care
right.
and give a damn. And
right.
You know, again, along with that comes a whole bunch of bullshit, but
right.
If I'm going to draw out like what the really positive, amazing parts of it are, I mean, it's extraordinary. And
yeah.
it's why, I think it's a moment for anybody to have that experience, right? Like go out there, find, you know, a crew of people that are getting involved and go do something. Which is also to say, like, don't just be on Twitter. There's like actual work that you can be doing, and it's extremely important. It's extremely impactful. And you meet really awesome people along the way.
Yeah, it's true. I worked on Barack Obama's campaign, and that was a life-changing experience for me. And it got me involved in elections later down the road. Like I've since volunteered on all the, you know, elections, presidential and off-year elections, but that it is an amazing experience. So if you're at home and you're feeling like, I don't know, I want to do something, it's super easy to do something. And it's like so rewarding and can be terrifying, but so rewarding.
And yeah, as you said, some of my lifelong friends, best friends in the entire world, I worked with on the Obama campaign. I mean, it was truly a life-changing experience.
Yeah. Okay. I just have a few more questions for you about writing and the book, and then we'll be done. But this question is always very important to me because I am a terrible speller. So what is a word that you can never spell correctly on the first try?
Oh, my goodness. Oh, I know.
Okay.
Misogynist.
Ooh. Misogynist. Okay. Good one. Good one. I can't spell that.
Yeah.
I can't spell any of the words. Every time someone says a word, I'm like, ooh, that I can't spell that one either. Okay. Last little bit. Oh, so I have to know. You have two daughters who are sisters, and then you have your mother and your aunt. What did the four of them think of the book? What was their response? It's like totally generational, like big jump. But what was that like for you and for them?
Yeah, I think for my mom and aunt, I think, you know, just it was obviously special. Again, it was nothing that any of us ever talked about, like, oh, it'd be cool if you wrote a book one day about us. Like this was
right.
not,
right.
I sort of just said, I think I'm going to go write this book. What do you think? They're like, okay. So they're very, you know, I think they're most of all, I think that they are proud of me. I think that they, are proud that, you know, I have this idea and I went for it. Just in the way that my book encourages all of us to do. I have not yet fully read it to my girls.
Okay.
I don't know what I'm waiting for. I feel like I just feel like it's such a big moment. And I feel like I don't want to just like, I feel like I need to like, I don't know, maybe I'm being too much of like a social, media person where I'm like, I feel like I have to videotape it or I have to
right.
like really document this moment, you know? Anyway, so I'm saving it up. I don't know for what. I felt like maybe I should wait until like launch day, which
yeah.
we're obviously inching closer and closer, or like day of, but I feel like it's such a special moment and I have not yet figured out like how I want to do that.
Okay.
So I have not, I have to report back.
Okay.
One of the funny things I've been thinking about though is like, they know that it's about grandma and auntie.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, do I change the names to calling the characters grandma and auntie? Because if these kids come away from me reading to the book to them with the real names and start calling grandma and auntie Kamala and Maya, like I'm getting banished from, I'm getting disowned. Like that is not going to be okay.
So
I need to figure out a strategy on that. Like, so what's interesting is, I mean, it's not hugely surprising, but my kids know that like my name is Mina and they know that daddy is Nick because he and I obviously call each other sometimes by our first names. And they know that Pop Pop's name is also Tony. That's the grandpa because they have heard me calling him Tony because I call him Tony.
Right.
However, they have never, ever, as far as I can remember, have ever heard me call like grandma Maya or auntie Kamala. And I actually, I can't remember what was going on, but I remember I will call her Kamala, which she hates, by the way.
Okay.
I kind of only started doing it in the presidential campaigns. I'm like, I'm a 35-year-old grown woman. I cannot be referring to you as like auntie. Like that's just not, she hates it. Anyway, there was some brief moment where my older one was like, Kamala, who's that? And I was like, oh my God, she almost like figured out what was going on. Anyway, so they don't know their real names. And if they do, like shit's going down.
Okay.
So I need to figure out how to read this.
I love that so much.
These are my really big struggles I have to like deal with.
Oh my gosh. Okay. I have one more question for you, but before I ask it, I just want to remind people at home that the book is called Kamala and Maya's Big Idea. It's by Mina Harris. You can get it wherever you get your books. There are 25 booksellers that Mina is partnered with. I will also link to it in the show notes and everything else we talked about today. And I will link to the Phenomenal Women Action Campaign. I will link to all the stuff. So it's all going to be there for you. And if you like this episode or you like the podcast, please take a moment to leave us a rating and a review. Okay, Mina, last question, and then we'll get out of here. For people who love your book, what are a handful or a couple of books that you think they might also like? They can be children's books. They can be books that you think are kind of in the same vein for adults. Just some things that you think might be exciting for people who read your book or read your book and think it's awesome.
I love that question. Thank you. I'm definitely such a big supporter of other authors of color in particular and others who are just writing incredible books that I think in the same way are sending, you know, positive messages to all children around diversity, especially. Hair Love is a big one that was big in our household. And part of that is just, you know, teaching our kids about hair care and different hair textures. And that one, actually they just, the author Matthew Cherry, who's also incredible, just won an Oscar for the short. So love telling people about that one. If they haven't, it would be crazy if they hadn't yet heard of it, but Hair Love is a big one. Another sort of related, subject matter is Bedtime Bonnet by Nancy Redd, which has been a big one. And I think I want to be clear that these books are much more specifically about Black hair. But I also think that, as I do with my book, that it's important to read these books to non-Black children.
Yes.
To learn about our differences, right? And
yes.
How each of us has a different daily routine. And I just think that it's so important that other kids are exposed to this. So Bedtime Bonnet, Hair Love, Sophia Valdez, Future Prez, that's a big
Is that part of the Ada Twist Scientist?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. So we have that whole series.
Love.
Amara, my older one, was, you know, saying that she wanted to be a president when Auntie was running for president. So that's a big one. Others, let's see, like Solway, I hope I'm pronouncing that properly.
Oh, yes.
By Lupita Nyong'o is a big one. The Proudest Blue by Ibtihaj Muhammad. That I'm naming ones that are more recent. Gosh, what else? Do you want more?
No, that's so good. That's so great. Usually people are like, I don't know.
Oh, no.
Beloved.
Okay.
So no, that's great. I love it.
I mean, it's part of the, you know, actually another really good one. Green is a Chili Pepper, which I love.
I don't know that one.
It's all about teaching colors, but it's through culture and cooking. And I really love that one too.
That's awesome.
But yeah, I mean, I could go on days, which is to say that, I mean, I'm actually quite proud to be or I think I can consider myself sort of part of this, I don't know, new, you know, class of authors of color that are putting this sort of children's literature into the world. Totally. And there's been incredible progress made there in the last, I'd say probably like 3 to 5 years. And I hope that they all get the recognition that all the white guys do.
Yeah.
And that more and more people read these books.
Yeah. And before I just want to echo what you said, because I think it's important that these books that are written with, you know, children of color in mind aren't just for children of color. Just because they're telling the stories of children of color doesn't mean that they're only for Latinx kids or Black kids or Asian kids, that these books are for all children, regardless of your own personal identity. Just like when we were kids, we read about James and the Giant Peach and nobody was like, no, this is only a story for white boys. So I just want to reiterate that point, because I think it's a great way to learn about other people and other cultures. And it's also just what the world looks like. So with all of that being said, Mina, thank you so much for being here. It's really been great chatting with you.
Thank you for having me. It's so exciting to, like, you are a podcaster now. You have this incredible, we went to high school together, and like, who could have imagined this moment? And you have this incredible podcast. So thank you so much for inviting me. I just love this. So I'm really appreciative.
Thank you. And everybody else, we will see you in the stacks. Thank you all so much for listening today. And thank you to Mina for being our guest. Thank you also to Jacqueline Franciscone for helping us facilitate this interview. Don't forget, the Stacks Book Club is reading Breathe by Imani Perry for our July 29th episode. And Kiese Lehman will be back as our guest to help us discuss. Find everything we talked about on today's episode in the link in the show notes. For more from The Stacks, follow us on social media at The Stacks Pod on Instagram and at The Stacks Pod _ on Twitter, and check out our website, thestackspodcast.com. To join The Stacks Pack and support the show, head to patreon.com/thestacks. And be sure to sign up for Libro FM using the code THESTACKS at checkout to get 2 audiobooks for the price of 1. Make sure you're subscribed to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And if you're listening through Apple Podcasts, please take a moment to rate and review the show. Our graphic designer is Robin McCrite, and our theme music is from Tegirigis. This show was created and produced by me, Tracy Thomas.